Hello and welcome. Scott Stevens sitting in for Richard Feidler today. My guest is John Kingston McMahon. When John was 2 years old, his mother abandoned him. Then, in circumstances he wouldn't understand for many years, he lost his father too. In 1952, John and his younger sister Kathy became wards of the state of New South Wales. He's chronicled his frequently heartbreaking but in every way extraordinary journey from these rather tragic beginnings in his memoirs, A Long Road to Gillacullen. John, welcome.
Thank you, Scott. Thanks for inviting me.
Let's begin with your birth parents. They arrived in Australia in 1949. What brought them here?
It was after the war. My father had gone to London from Ireland to look for work, and immigration was obviously in full swing to America and to Australia. And he just decided that there's a new world, a new land out there. Now, he hadn't married my mother, which I didn't know, obviously, but he purported her to be his wife, and immigration being slack in those days, they didn't check. So my mother had abandoned another child in an orphanage in Manchester in 1941, left her husband, he was a soldier. So I'd found that much out in the journey. And obviously she was never meant to have children because she obviously didn't like children. And they came to Australia. There was a farmer, Ron Mould was his name, and he used to meet all the immigrant ships in Sydney. And he was always looking for Irish workers, especially Irish farm workers. And he had a big farm called Kybian in the back blocks of Nimitabell in New South Wales. And he asked my father if he'd like to come down there. He had workers' cottages. He had over 3,000 acres. And that's how we ended up in just outside Nimitabell. And that's why the search revolves so much about Nimitabell, was because as a child I had this name in my mind, this town in my mind, as to where my father was supposedly killed and supposedly buried, but it wasn't to be. But
What memories do you have of your father from this time?
I have one distinct memory. He laughed. He had a booming laugh. He was a big man. I've got a picture of him. And he laughed one day because I stood at the farm gate. There was a little worker's house there, and I wasn't allowed to go out the gate. And I remember waiting for him to come down the dirt road. And I heard him coming down the road whistling, and he had a banana. And he gave me a banana. And I'd never seen a banana. And he laughed so much because he handed me this banana. And that's probably the only live memory I actually have of him. And the one thing I like to think was that my father left me with a legacy of being able to laugh. And he did. I have other memories as a child. I have a memory of my sister and I are standing on the side of a hill. We're looking down this little steam train running up and down the yard, and it seemed a long way away. And as a child, I was only interested in that. And there was a man standing in a long black dress, and there was a hole in the ground. And what I never knew, and I always had that memory, but what I never knew was that I was standing at the graveside of my father, and the man in the long dress was the priest officiating at that time. And I spent a long time looking for that location.
What about your mother? Any strong memories, any similarly strong memories of your mum?
Have no memories or emotions about my mother whatsoever. I spent a small amount of time looking for her, but it was only a cursory look. It was just with birth, deaths and marriages in Sydney, and there was no sign of her ever dying. But as far as going back to England or Ireland, I have no idea. And it's been dead end after dead end. And I never really spent a lot of time looking because I never had this desire inside me to find her. And that's very strange for a child, which sort of falls in line with the information that I'd found about her abandoning, you know, a child prior to us, abandoning the sister and I.
So what happened when your mum did leave?
Well, the information I've got was that she formed another relationship because the farm was so large. My father would be sent off for days at a time, like a jackaroo, and repairing fences or whatever. And because there were several houses with other farm workers on it, apparently she formed a relationship with another farm worker, and they just disappeared. They just upped and disappeared. And that was in 1950. And it was within the first 8 months of arriving from England, when they had immigrated over here. My father had a nervous breakdown by all reports that we've got later on. He ended up in an institution in Goulburn, had a nervous breakdown. They used to do electric shock treatment in those days. And I did research on that place in Goulburn. I can't think of the name of it right now. But apparently everyone that undergone shock treatment actually committed suicide. And so it was banned sometime later. And so here's my father in a strange land with no family support, with two young children. So, because my mother had taken off and she just left us on the farm. And my sister and I ended up in Ashfield Orphanage in Sydney. So...
Was that during the time that your father was still alive, or was that only after he took his
own life? No, that was after he died. That was after he died. And I do have some sort of vague memory about that. I have this feeling, I've always had this feeling that I was in the room when he lay on the bed, but I couldn't understand it. And I don't know whether that's my imagination but I have this feeling, I've always had this feeling about, because I was obviously very close to my father, but at 2.5 years old, you know, barely three, it was just this thing that, so he had died, we ended up in the orphanage. And, yeah.
You were eventually placed, though, both you and your sister, yep, were eventually placed with a very devout Catholic family. Can you tell me about Paddy and Alice McMahon?
Well, Paddy was a returned soldier. He was a hard, emotionless man. Whether that was because of the war and what he'd seen and done during the war. They were children of the Depression, the Great Depression, and nothing was wasted, and they were very tight with everything they did. They didn't want a little boy, but because my mother was alive, the rules said that we could only be fostered, Kathy and I could only be fostered out. We were never allowed to be adopted, because to be adopted, the living parent would have to have authorised our adoption.
Even though she couldn't be located?
Even though she couldn't be located, that's the way the system was. We could be adopted. Well, the McMahons wanted a little girl. Alice was desperate for a little girl, and the only little girl at that stage was my sister, and Kathy's 18 months older than me. And so I was the baggage that came with my sister.
And were you keenly aware of that at the time?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, you felt that as part of your lived experience with the McMahons?
Absolutely. Because from my youngest recollections with the McMahons, I was always trying to escape. I was the worst escape artist in history, as the story tells you. But yeah, I was keenly aware. A child knows when they're not wanted from any age, and so I was in the way, and I needed to be free. It was as simple as that.
You've written that you felt that Paddy was quite simply incapable of demonstrating affection.
Yes.
Affection specifically towards you, or was the entire family situation rather affectionless?
Yeah, it was an affectionless family. Kathy received very little affection from him also. He was a dictatorial man. He would go crooked Alice, and he was... Alice had to do everything the way Paddy wanted it, and she was very compliant, because it was just the times, I suppose, that women did as the male in the family told them to do. He was just an emotionless man. He did have emotion. It took me many years to find that he had emotion. He had emotion in his garden. Hmm. His garden was what kept him focused, and any love emotion that he had, he expressed in his garden, because he was a great gardener, and he had a beautiful garden in Blackheath in the Blue Mountains, which is a lovely place in its own right, but he spent countless hours in that garden.
We are jumping way ahead in the story here, but you really have put your finger on something that really struck me when you went back later in life to see Paddy.
Yep.
The way that you describe him, I mean, in many ways you would have been entitled, I think, most readers of your book would feel that you were entitled to feel a degree of malice, at least resentment, perhaps even anger. But that isn't the series of emotions that you describe, is it? How did you feel when you saw Paddy again in sort of later in his life, and also he took you for a tour around the garden again?
I felt pity for him. That's the only emotion I could have. I was starting to find some strength within me to shut out the pain, and I just felt pity in the end, because he couldn't hurt me anymore. He couldn't hurt me physically. He couldn't hurt me emotionally. I'd closed all those doors, and he was now just an old man.
Had you forgiven him?
No.
Okay.
No. I possibly could have forgiven him if he'd told me the answer that I wanted, that I was always looking for.
What was that?
I wanted to know what had happened to my father. And when I went to the nursing home and he sat there as an old man with the blanket over his knee and his watery eyes looked at me, and it was the only time I ever asked him. I'd asked Alice many times about my father. She wouldn't tell me. But Paddy, I thought I had him right on the edge that particular day. And he just said, let it go, you have no need to know, or words to that effect. Hmm. And so that was about the closest I ever came with emotion with Paddy. And I let it go, because you just learn to let things go. You know, you can only get kicked so many times it doesn't hurt anymore. Hmm. So that's the way it was. But no, I had no malice towards him. It was just the way it was. And I suppose I was very lucky that I've always had this strong will about me and the ability to, just close in on myself and shut out the world whenever I need to.
You mentioned before that you're one of the worst escape artists in history. In fact, I mean, your misery, I think that's the only word to describe it, your misery at the McMahon household was pretty apparent. And in fact, if we can just sort of rejoin the timeline, your first escape attempt was at 6 years old. And that was the beginning of, I really have to say, John, a rather long association that you had with the police over about the next 13 years.
Yep, that's right. When I hid in that little cupboard in the front room of the McMahon's house, because I just didn't want to go to Blackheath every Friday night. But there was this...
They lived at the stage in Arncliffe, didn't they?
They lived at Arncliffe, and they had a nice house at Arncliffe. But Alice had this passion about the Blue Mountains, and she just loved it. And a lot of people in those days went to the Blue Mountains for weekend things. There were lots of guest houses and things like that in the 40s and the 50s and even earlier than that. And I don't know why Alice had this association with the Blue Mountains, but she wanted to live up there. So they had this little tiny shack in Blackheath, and it was just a two-room weekender. But every Friday night, it was just a dreadful experience for a child. It was half an hour walk from Arncliffe to the station. It was another half an hour to go to Central Station. It was an old steam train. Used to climb 3,500 feet up to Blackheath, because it's the highest point in the Blue Mountains. Used to get to Valley Heights, which is 2/3 of the way up, and they put another steam train on, a steam engine on, to get it up the highest part of the mountains. Now, that was an hour, just sat there on a train. So then you got off at Blackheath at 9 o'clock at night to be freezing cold, and you had over a mile to walk, which was a long way for little legs, and it was dark, and then you'd go into this place and you'd go to bed, and all we ever seemed to do was walk and sleep and go to church, and I hated it.
You ran away. The police, strangely enough, and I wonder why, they actually took a degree of compassion on you, moved you out of the McMahon household for a while, and put you in a place called Royalston.
No.
That's a little bit later down
there.
Yeah,
Royalston was the home of the devil.
Oh, yes.
they took me to Brougham.
That's right.
Brougham was the 4 weeks or 5 weeks, whatever it was, of being a child. Hmm. It was a joyous place. But the police only did that because everything, I got all the reports from the welfare, and I've got them at home now. They only did that under the instructions of the child welfare. They decided they didn't know what to do with me, because we had this problem that I couldn't be farmed out to anyone else because I had to be with my sister until they could get permission. So that's why they kept sending me back to the McMahons all the time, was because it was just a bureaucratic nightmare for someone and they just didn't want to address the issue.
Did you ever resent your sister through this process?
No. I've always loved my sister and we're still very close.
You mentioned Royalston, the yes. House of the Devil.
Yes.
This was, I mean, you were branded effectively a wayward child.
Yes.
This is after multiple escape attempts from the McMahon house.
Yep.
You were also involved in some petty theft, if I can put it that way. But it was the experience of Royalston itself that
yep.
looms really terribly
yep.
in your memoirs. Can you tell me about that?
Royalston's still there. It's a B&B now. It was an old gentleman's residence, and I believe it belonged to a magistrate or something in later life in Victorian times after it was built. The child welfare took it over, I think, in before the war sometime. They would house anywhere between a dozen and 20 boys at a time in a similar situation to me. The dormitory was upstairs, and it was run something straight out of Charles Dickens. You marched everywhere, you couldn't talk, you couldn't laugh, you weren't allowed to do anything. And if you did, you were caned.
How old were you, John?
I was 11 the first time I was sent there. And friendships were always short-term affairs as a welfare kid, for any welfare kid, because kids would come, kids would go, and you'd just get friendly with someone, they'd disappear. I made friends with a sad little boy who, he was always being caned. I think it was a personality thing between the housemaster, and I'll call him Peter, and I called him Peter in the story. But I distinctly remembered his legs. His legs were like tram tracks. The white scarring on the back of his calves and his thighs were, and there were lots of scabs on his legs because he was always caned before the other sores healed up. And he was the saddest person I've probably ever known in my entire life, even in recent times. His eyes were just little black pools of nothing. He had no laughter, no joy. He obviously had nothing to look forward to. And I first met him when he was curled up in the corner of a yard after he'd been beaten again. And I always had this thing about trying to cheer people up. So even then I tried to cheer him up just by talking to him. And the only thing I knew how to do was escape. And I remember sitting on the ground with him and just said, "I'm going to run away." And his eyes perked up just a little bit and he said, "Could he come with me?" And I'd never ever thought of anyone coming with me. But I felt sorry for him. And I could see that he was in a lot of pain. Even when I was 11, he was 10. And we made plans to run away. And the housemaster heard our plans. And if you went to the housemaster's office, you were always in for a caning. And he told me to go upstairs and stand at the end of my bed. And I thought that was a bit strange because nobody had ever got a caning in the dormitory. And he told Peter to go to the office. And it was the last time I ever saw Peter. I heard his screaming when I was standing at the end of the bed, and then the screaming stopped suddenly. The housemaster came up with a long strap, had two buckles on it, and they were cast iron beds. And he strapped me, put one buckle around my elbow on my left arm, and he put the other buckle around the bed end, and he left me there for 24 hours. And there was no food or water or toilet facilities. And the next day when the matron came up, I slept on the end of the bed there, we're still tied to it. And the next morning the matron came up and I got dressed, and we weren't allowed to talk at mealtimes. Not the mealtimes or anything fancy, but I whispered to the boy next door, where was Peter, because I couldn't see him. And this boy just whispered, he said, Peter's dead. I was shocked. I couldn't understand it. You knew what the word dead meant, but I'd never been associated with death. And I was trying to avoid being caught for speaking because I knew I'd get a hiding if I was caught speaking. And I said, what do you mean he's dead? And he said he was getting a caning. And then the yellow ambulance, because Sydney ambulances were yellow in those days, the yellow ambulance came and took him away on a stretcher with a blanket over him. And that was the end of that relationship. But I can only assume that he had a weak heart or he just lost the will to live.
That renewed your desperation to get out of there, to
yes.
escape, didn't it?
Yeah, it did.
How did it happen? How did you get out?
Well, we all had jobs. We all had to do jobs, even though we were children. We were sort of unpaid slaves. My job was to polish all the brasswork. And there was lots of brasswork in houses in those days, door handles and finger plates. And there was a big brass plaque out the front on the fence, and it just said Royalston. And that was the only time I was allowed out the front gate. I used to have a little box and had brass on rags and things in it. And I went out there to polish that, but I'd made up my mind that today I was going. It was as simple as that. So I went around and I knew as soon as they saw me going out there with my box of cleaning material that nobody would be really looking for me because they knew what they'd did. I went outside, I looked around, didn't see anyone, put the box down and I was gone. And I ran like, you know, the devil was 2 feet behind me. So I can still remember that.
You eventually made your way back, though, to the McMahons, didn't you?
I went back to, I was going back to Arncliffe because I was going to pinch some more milk money to fund my escape.
Milk money and churches seem to be your two favourite places to grab a bit of money from.
Well, people would, you know, I'll probably go to hell for this, but people would burn candles in memory of someone in the churches, and they'd put a penny in or a tuppence or threepence or whatever it was, and it was only a little tin. And so the money was always a temptation. So I thought, my initial plan when I had escaped from Royalston was to go back there, wait till it was dark, grab some milk money from the houses that I knew where they put it out, and then run away and find a circus to join. That was my grand plan as a child. But I went past the Catholic Church, and all of a sudden plans changed, and I thought, oh, the church is in there. I know they've got candle money. So I went in there, and sure enough, I managed to twist the can around enough that I could, off the stand, and only had a little flimsy little lock on it, and I broke it. And in my greed, I didn't see the church warden come up behind me and he caught me. But luckily, they didn't send me back to Royalston. They sent me off to Mittagong, so after I was caught there.
And how old were you at this stage?
I was only 11.
Okay.
When I was caught that time. So, yeah.
And Mittagong was a juvenile detention centre. Was it more of a prison? Was it more of a school? What was it?
It was called the Toombong Home for Delinquent Boys. Delinquent, that's what it's called. The Toombong Homes for Delinquent Boys. And there were 12 homes, and they were welfare homes, and they were in different age groups and different religious groups. And one of the homes that I remember was a hospital home. But the rest of us, we had a special school that we'd have to go to, and it was on a place called Bong Bong Road in Mittagong, which is still there, but which is all upmarket houses now, so all the houses have gone, I think. I think they've all been destroyed. But that's where I went, and I spent, I had two stints down there. But it was tolerable. It wasn't like Royalston. Yes, you got punished for fighting and whatever. That's when I first learned how to polish a wall with a brick. But by the same token, as a kid, I enjoyed it because my second stint down there, they stuck me on a dairy, and I enjoyed my time at the dairy. So
your first stint at Mittagong, you were there for 2 years. Is that right?
Yep. And then, lo and behold, they said, you're going home. And I thought, where the hell's home? and they sent me back to the McMahons.
On air, online, and on your mobile. This is Conversations on ABC Radio.
Scott Stevens here, sitting in for Richard Feidler today. Richard is on the mend from a bout of tonsillitis, but I'm particularly glad to be here with our guest, John Kingston McMahon. John and his sister Kathy were orphaned at the age of 3 when their father committed suicide shortly after his wife ran off with another man. This was, in many ways, the tragic beginnings of his lifelong search for family, for home. You were about 11, 12 years old this stage. You had just entered for the first time Mittagong Youth Training Center, which was a home for juvenile delinquency.
Yes.
You mentioned, it really is interesting to me the way that you describe it, because in many ways that was a kind of reprieve for you. You were there for 2 years.
Yes.
You were out back home with your foster parents, the McMahons, and yet incredibly miserable at school. And that shortly saw you get back to Mittagong.
Yes.
Can you just talk me through that transition going out of Mittagong the first time, your experience at school, and then how did things change the second time around?
Okay. They called me in the office one day and they just said, McMahon, you're going home. I had no idea what that meant. It was a long way from Mittagong to Blackheath. But in those days, children were still seen to be seen and not heard. And kids in my position were never game to ask questions. Where are we going? Why are we going? Etc. Because all you would get was a backhander across the face or a kick up the bum. So I sat there. I went to sleep in the car and I woke up. We were in front of a strange house because in the meantime, the McMahons had moved to Blackheath permanently. They'd bought a house. And they walked me up the pathway, and lo and behold, Paddy opened the door and nearly died. And
how did you feel?
Absolutely devastated. I was shocked. Was the only way to describe it. I was probably speechless. One of the few times in my life that I probably was speechless, but I was speechless. And I knew the lecture would come and how I had to behave myself, and it did come after dinner. And they had a room out the back, which was half a room shared with the shed. So there was a bed put in there, and there was no electricity. And after Kathy and I washed the dishes, because that would be our job each night, and I was to get a candle and I was to go out the back room, and that's where I would sit, because there was no television or anything like that. And so you just curl up in bed and go to sleep, because it was a very cold place. And so Alice was a dreadful cook, and as much as I'm still a food philistine even all those years later, the one food I can't stand is tripe. And it was Paddy's favourite meal, tripe with this gooey white sauce all over it. And it was just like, it had the texture of a car tyre chopped into small pieces and probably about as chewy. Except it was white and it had all this gunk all over it. And Paddy had this philosophy that, being a child of the Depression, that you had to eat everything. If there was a little bit of everything on your plate, and you didn't leave your plate until everything was gone. It didn't matter how long it took. So lo and behold, I went in the kitchen and Alice was cooking tripe, Paddy's favourite meal. And I got into trouble at school. There was a Christian brother there who was always beating me. It was his plan in life to give me some discipline, because I joined school through the semester. I had no idea what I was supposed to be learning. There was nobody to assist you. And because I couldn't do my homework correctly, you'd get a caning every morning. So Alice had told him, when I went into the class, that I'd been a delinquent child, I'd been locked up and rah, 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 and the whole class heard it. And so that was very embarrassing.
She said this in front of the entire class.
She said this in front of the entire class. And she told Brother George, and Brother George, in those days, the teachers taught everything. And Brother George was a pig of a man. He may have gone under the title of being a Christian brother, and he wore a crucifix around his neck, but he was far from a man of God. And he used to keep a little strap in his pocket, and he would belt anybody at any time with the strap. But if you fail to comply with homework and stuff like that, he would pull the cane out of the cupboard, and you stood up the front of there and he would belt you with the cane on your hand. Four cuts just for a mediocre sort of thing. But because he took my inability to understand what the educational issues were, and my homework was invariably wrong, he took it as willful disobedience. So then we started off with six cuts on the hand, and then we started with six cuts on each hand, and then we started with six cuts on the downward stroke and six cuts on the upward stroke on each hand. And it all came to a head on that Friday. It was very snowy, it was very cold, and he'd given me a caning on both sides of my hands in front of the class, and I'd wet myself, and I passed out. And I woke up in the first aid room. When I woke up, they wanted me to go back to the class, and I was gone. I just grabbed my bag and I was gone. And Paddy wouldn't provide us with coats or anything, because the only clothes we could have was what the welfare provided us with. And so I had a jumper and a plastic raincoat, and that's all they were in those days, was plastic, and they used to rip. They weren't nylon like now. And I remember thinking to myself that I was going to freeze to death, so I walked up to Katoomba Station, and they had a fire going in the waiting room, and I sat there, and I didn't know what to do. It was the Friday night. I trudged through the snow. I got home early. Alice was going crook because I got home early. Paddy wasn't happy and said I was going back to school on Monday. And then, lo and behold, the Saturday night, they were cooking tripe. And in one way, it was good, because I ended up scooping. I was the last. It was Kathy, she'd finished. Paddy and Alice had left the table. I had this pile of tripe on there, and I scooped it up with a handkerchief and I put it in my pocket. When I went out to my little room, I just pulled the handkerchief out of my pocket and I scattered the tripe, but stupid me, it was right outside the back door, and Paddy found it. So the next morning he found it on our way to Mass, and then all I knew I had was another belting when after Mass. So I made up my mind that I'd run away during Mass. And so that's what I did. I took off. I jumped on the train. I didn't get far. I got halfway down the Blue Mountains to a place called Springwood, and the policeman came up and he caught me. And he was all right, the first copper, and he took me away. But the second copper, TV had just arrived in Australia in those days, and the second copper, who was supposed to take me back to the court on the Monday morning, he was really annoyed with me because he'd been home at Penrith and he'd been watching something on television, and he was told to come to Springwood and pick me up and take me back. So in those days, coppers were allowed to belt kids. It was just normal fare for, you know, that's why I suppose the kids respected the police, because it was painful not to. And so he was annoyed because I'd interrupted his television watching. It was new to Australia in those days. So he gave me a caning when I arrived at the police station. He took me out the police cells out the back of Penrith Police Station, and he left me there all night. And the next morning I was taken off to the children's court again, and that's when I was sent back to Mittagong.
As a repeat offender.
Offender. But I didn't have to eat the tripe, and that was the last time I ever ate tripe. And and I didn't have to go back to the McMahons. So it was a blessing in disguise.
You were about 14 years old at this stage.
Yep.
Between 14 and 19, I think you can charitably say that you were in and out of prison.
Yep.
We haven't got time to go through the details, but I'm just wondering, what was driving you? I mean, reading your book, reading your story, you weren't a bad young man. You know, I mean, you almost kind of reminded me of a kind of Dickensian innocent rogue.
Yep.
You weren't bad, but you were searching. You were wanting something. What did you want? What was the light at the end of the tunnel? What were you looking for?
I knew that my father was dead, but I wanted to know where he was. This was what was driving me, because the McMahons would never tell me, but the only name that was ever mentioned was Nimitabelle. So in my mind, I believed that he was buried in Nimitabelle. But because I had the memory of standing on a hill looking at a little train, I knew that that was obviously his grave site. But when I went back to Nimitabelle a few times, I went to the cemetery. There was no train line. There was no hill. There was nothing. I knew I was in the wrong place, but I had no idea that where I was looking for was only 14 miles down the road at Cooma. And I had this thing in my mind, I don't know why, subconsciously, that if I found where my father's grave was and I could sit on his grave or I could kneel on his grave or whatever, that I'd be with my father again. And it wasn't to be, and it was just a silly childhood dream, but that was what was driving me. If people had told me the truth, maybe it would have been totally different. Maybe we wouldn't be sitting here now. But people wouldn't tell me the truth. And all I wanted as a child was to be told what had happened to my father. It was never my mother, what had happened to my father. And I think every child has a right to know that.
You left prison at 19. You discovered that your sister Kathy had since moved to Western Australia.
Yes.
You made your way across the continent, which I can only imagine would have been extraordinary.
It was an adventure.
You met back up with your sister again and found yourself in prison in Fremantle once again.
Yes.
This time was different, though.
Yeah.
You got out of prison and you made a promise to yourself.
I did. The Salvation Army were very good to me. They gave me £5. I thought the only place I could recognise as home, which was familiarity, was Sydney. And I thought maybe if I came back there. And there was plenty of work in those days. You could walk around the streets and there were always signs on factories. Because the Snowy Mountain scheme was in full swing and all the immigrants were going down there where the big money was, and the factories were screaming out for labour. I'd turned that into a little business of my own, getting sacked and getting a week's pay and then getting another job and getting sacked again. It was great. But so I knew that if I got back to Sydney, wouldn't be too hard to get a job in a factory and then find a boarding house and just make a life for myself. And but when they sent me back, they'd given me a letter of introduction to a place called the Matthew Talbot Hostel for old men, for homeless men. And it was in Surry Hills, which is a trendy part of Sydney now, but in those days it was a bit of a slum. And I took it up there, and I was just a kid, and I got in the queue because they wouldn't open the doors before about 5 p.m. at night, and they had so many beds, and they'd give you a hot meal, and you're allowed to have a bed, and if you had a fight or anything else, you got turfed back out in the street. And then you had to be gone by 9 o'clock in the morning and make out your own way. But I was determined that there was more to life than being locked up like an animal. And it was a real wake-up call for me when the Salvation Army had given me my ticket, train ticket back from Perth to Sydney. And I saw the chap at the Matthew Talbot Hostel, and I was standing there in a queue with smelly old men.
And did you have a vision of yourself?
Yes, I did. Mm. And I looked at all these old men who, for whatever reason, had ended up here. And I thought, this is me. It was a vision into the future. And I'd been on the street long enough to be a bit savvy. And I thought, this is not for me. It's not what I want.
John, at the risk of making a meal out of your story, which I really have to say moved me deeply, I mean, trains were so much a part of your experience as a young man.
Yes.
In some ways, it's quite fitting that eventually you would move from Sydney. And I do wonder about even cutting your heartstrings. It was Sydney that held you close to where your father was buried. Nonetheless, you left New South Wales. You met your wife, Liz.
Yeah.
You ended up in Victoria. And of all things, you ended up as a train driver.
Yeah.
But in the middle of all this, there was one event that looms large in your book. You had been driving trains for about 12 years by this stage.
Yes.
1988. How old were you in 1988?
30. I was about 40.
Okay.
Yeah.
You were driving the trains.
Yes.
What happened?
There were three of us on the train, which when you're a train driver, there's quite often more than one driver that needs to drive it because you need to go and pick up another train. You travel around, you do various things. And we'd all just jumped on. We'd grabbed our coffee just another morning and we were running express down to Frankston, which is an outer suburb of Melbourne. And we were routed at Caulfield, which is a junction station, to the outside line, which is the express line. Now, there's three lines at Ormond, and they're bi-directional, two of them bi-directional, depending on the peak, morning or afternoon, and one just in an up direction, which is towards the city. So we're on the outside line, it's the left line, and there's a middle line which had a train stationary at the station. The outside line going back to Melbourne, that was vacant. So we came down the hill, it's a very busy level crossing, multiple lanes, North Road, and we were just talking, mucking around just like you do, and as we're halfway down, blew the whistle, halfway down the platform, I noticed the front of a car came around from behind the stationary train in the centre platform. And I was shocked because it was a protected crossing. And at that stage, I couldn't see any more than just the headlights. And in my mind, it flashed through, if he stays right there, I'll take it off. I'll just take his headlights off. And it all happened very quickly. But he didn't stay there. And then I noticed it was a police car and he had his flashing lights on. And he was at an angle to the stationary train. And I was looking down. And he was looking up under his sun visor. And I locked eyes with him. And it was all in slow motion, even though it was happening very quickly. And the instant I locked my eyes onto his, he lurched forward as his whole body hit the accelerator because it just dawned on him that we were running express and we weren't going to stop. Now, I'd seen the Mercedes go through. There was a red Mercedes went tearing through and it was a stolen car, as it turned out. And this young copper had been out delivering summonses and he got the call and he saw the Mercedes going down North Road. So he took off after it. The Mercedes went through the crossing. He thought he'd catch it and he didn't. He looked up, and in that instant, he knew that he was going to die, and I knew that he was going to die. And the train hit his car at 80 kilometres an hour, so 250 tonnes. His engine was to the left of us, his boot was to the right of us, and we picked the car up. The car exploded in the windscreen, fell down the front, train ran over the front of the car. We pushed him, it was on a bit of a downhill gradient, pushed him 360 metres and the car was just like a bulldozer. We just kicked all the ballast and people were screaming and the fumes and the smoke filled up the cab. And I jumped up that hard that there was a big square box in one part of the cab which was housed all the radio equipment. And I just went head first into this box on the corner of the box And just for a couple of seconds, I thought I was going to die. In actual fact, I was sure I was going to die. I had a vision, and I don't know why I had a vision. I had a vision of the police standing at the front door telling my wife that I'd been killed in a train wreck. But as soon as I saw that vision in my mind, it was gone. And then all I did was hurt. My head, I couldn't hear anything. I smelled the fumes, and the whole cab was just full of dirt and dust and everything, and the train was rocking around because we'd derailed the front couple of wheels, and I thought the train was going to tip over, and eventually we stopped 360 metres, and the worst thing I ever did was climb down and put my head under the front of that train, and this young policeman, Cameron Malone's his name, and I looked into his eyes that were alive a couple of minutes earlier, but now they were dead and just staring. It had a profound effect on me, that. Took me nearly a year. I thought I'd go back to work a week later, but I wouldn't. They just set up the train driver's trauma clinic because somebody realised that train drivers can be victims too. And every time I went to sleep, every time I laid in bed, I could just see his eyes. And sometimes they were almost open, other times they were wide awake and his mouth had opened. And I knew I was going crazy. I just knew it. And there was nothing I could do about it. But I became friends with the psychiatrist. And every Tuesday for an hour, I used to go off to the trauma clinic. And after a while, he asked me about my childhood. and that particular psychiatrist dragged it all out, and that particular psychiatrist was the one that actually got me a death certificate of my father through a couple of freaky events. He asked me about my father, and I said I'd given up looking, told him why, told him about Nimita Bell, and he said, let's make a phone call to the coroner's court. So at that moment, he picked up the phone. There were no mobiles in those days, and he just rang up the Cooma coroner's office. He said that he was a doctor and he had a patient, and we were looking for information on a Joseph Kingston's death in 1950, thereabouts. And I knew something was happening because I looked across the desk and I saw his eyes widen open, and he said, would you fax that through to me? He was talking to this chap for about 5 minutes, and he came and sat next to me, and he put his hand on my knee and he said, I'm really having trouble coming to grips with what I've just been told. And he said that chap that I just spoke to, he said, was transferring everything from paperback records onto computer, and he just transferred your father's records onto computer. And he was sending through the death certificate. And he faxed it through, came through about 10 minutes later. And on it, it had Joseph Kingston, Goola Cullen, County Cork, place of birth. I couldn't believe it. I was just ecstatic. I thought it was a town. As it turned out, it would take me another 4 years after I got that death certificate to actually find where Goola Cullen was. And hence the name A Long Way to Goola Cullen, because the next 4 years I went to libraries, I went to Irish societies, I rang up Ireland numerous times trying to find out, and all I could get was it was probably a small town that was swallowed up when Ireland became a republic. This was the kind of thing they told me. And but it wasn't a small town. And another freaky event happened. And I've always done things on the spur of the moment. And I came home and I said to Liz, I'm going to ring Ireland. She said, who are you going to ring this time? I said, I'm going to ring a Catholic church in Cork. It was 11:45. I got onto the international operator and I said, could you put me through to a Catholic church in Cork? She said, which one? I said, the biggest. She said, I'll put you through to Cork Cathedral. So this lady came through with an Irish brogue and she said, how could I help you? I told her what I was after. In the background, I heard a male voice and said, who's that you're talking to, Mary? She said, it's a man in Australia. I got on to him. He listened to my story for a few minutes, 10 minutes, didn't interrupt. And as sure as I'm sitting here, he said, this is your lucky day, son. He said, I've just buried your grandfather. And I nearly fell over and I thought I was dreaming. And I was screaming down the phone at him, and where is Goola Cullen? Where is Goola Cullen? There's no place. I can't find it anywhere. He said, that's the name of your family's farm. He said, it's called a townland. It's 20 miles outside a little town called Dunman Way, which you can find on any Irish map. So that took me to Ireland.
How long did it take for you to... How long until you actually went?
We had to sort everything out with work and the business, so it probably took about 10 or 12 weeks. And we were off. And actually, before that... the priest told me that I had a cousin still alive on the farm. His name was Jack. I couldn't contact him because he didn't have a phone. He was pretty illiterate, pretty well illiterate. But he used to go into town every Wednesday for his drink. And one of my cousin's daughters who lived in Australia had gone back to be with her mother. She used to go back for 3 months at a time. And she decided she wanted to go and see her cousin Jack, and she ran into him at the pub. She knew he'd be in the pub on Wednesdays. And Jack's friend said, tell her about the strange letter from Australia, because I'd written to my cousin Jack. So they raced back to Goola Cullen and they got the letter, and Eileen read it and she couldn't believe it. And she rang her husband, who was living in New South Wales, and he rang me and said, don't get too excited. I need to know the name of your grandfather and your grandmother. And they were on the birth on the death certificate. So I found a family.
The process of, I mean, your memory is extraordinary. I just have to say, your memory is extraordinary. Yeah. But remembering what you've had to remember, and then even seeing hard evidence of things that you just had these slivers of memory, are you a different person for having written the book, for having gone through the process of devoting, what was it, 19, 20 months to writing? Are you different for having done it?
I've cursed myself for writing it. I have cursed myself, and in hindsight, I probably wouldn't do it again. But as I was focused on doing it for my eldest granddaughter, that's what kept me going with it, even though it was very painful. So I don't think I'm a different person. I'm the same person. I'm just a bit overwhelmed with the way things have gone since I've written the book.
John, I really do have to thank you so very much. It's a difficult story to tell, but you've done it beautifully. Thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you, Scott.
John Kingston McMahon's memoir is called A Long Way to Gillacullen. Richard Feidler, God willing, should be back later in the week. Get well, Richard. I'm Scott Stevens. Thank you so much for listening.
On air, online, and on your mobile. This is Conversations on ABC Radio.